Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namāsāmi. Tonight is the night of the full moon of November, the ending of the rainy season, end of the year in the Thai calendar of 2562. The plan is for myself to go to Sri Lanka tomorrow evening, leaving here about 5 o'clock, and being met at the airport by Ajahn Vinita and Ajahn Appamado, and then to be traveling through Sri Lanka, hopefully in a on a low-key visit, and to principally go to the ancient holy places of Sri Lanka, the ancient monasteries and shrines, the centers of Dhamma practice of that country that have been established for many, many years, many centuries. That's the aim. And then following that, I've been invited to go to Bodh Gaya. There's a Buddhist group, the origins of it, interestingly enough, are from a Tibetan Buddhist group on the west coast of America, but they sponsor a recitation of the Pali Canon every year. This is about the 14th or 15th year in a row. This happens at Bodh Gaya for about 2 weeks, reciting the Tipitaka, piece by piece. So about 3,000 or 4,000 people gather for that every year. So I've been invited to give the opening talk to launch that event this year, and give a talk the next day as well. And then following that, I'm due to go to Thailand. I often go in December, pretty much every year, and to respond to invitations to teach in Bangkok, and going to Ubon to pay respects to the Chaitya of Lumpur Chao's relics, and to meet the Sangha, spend time at the International Forest Monastery, and then to lead a week-long retreat up in the Chiang Mai area, again, that I do pretty much every year. These are my travel plans. Particularly, I've never, it's significant for myself, I've never been to Sri Lanka before, at least not in this lifetime. Never been to Sri Lanka, never been to Myanmar, never been to Laos, never been to Cambodia, never been to Vietnam. So many of the southern Buddhist countries I haven't been to. I've received many, many invitations over the years, but I always like to wait for the appropriate occasion. And in particular, Ajahn Vinita has been encouraging me to accept the invitation to go to Sri Lanka, and he's taken a lot of trouble to arrange this and to set everything up in a good way. One of the things that you come across in the Pali Canon, when the Buddha's talking about after his own passing away, he describes in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta the appropriate way of looking after his relics after he's been cremated, and the relics have been divided up between the different groups. And he talks about establishing shrines, the place where he was born, the place of his enlightenment, the place where he gave the first teaching, and the place of his final passing away. And over and over again, he says that these are places that people can go to pay their respects, And to visit such places, these are, I say, the very act of visiting such places and paying respects, cultivating the quality of dedication and devotion. He says this will be for an individual's long-lasting welfare and happiness. So part of the motivation to go not just to Bodh Gaya on this time, but which is the place of the Buddha's enlightenment, but to go to the ancient monasteries of Sri Lanka, is to go to those same kind of those shrines, those places of Dhamma practice. Some of them, like Mahintale, where the Arahant Mahinda, the son of Emperor Ashoka, was an Arahant bhikkhu and arrived in Sri Lanka and established a monastery, a place called Mahintale now. And that's been in continuous use, apparently, as a monastery for about 300 years. So 23 centuries of continuous occupation, continuous Dhamma practice. And his sister, the Arahant nun Sangamita, she brought the a branch of the Bodhi tree from Bodh Gaya. She brought that in as a long description of her gathering the branch and having it in a large pot, bringing it in the pot on the boat to the island of Tambapani, as Sri Lanka was known in those days, and then planting the Bodhi tree at Anuradhapura, if I remember the history correctly. And so these places have had a continuous focus. The land has been trodden on by the feet of thousands, millions and millions of devotees, people coming with sincere intention, people coming who have heard the Buddha's teaching, have taken refuge in the Triple Gem, people who have, say, been trying to guide their lives, their hearts and minds towards the goodness and away towards goodness and away from the unskillful, and so that the effect of going to such places, I find, is that there's a profound effect upon the heart. The one of the traditional names for the places, the four main shrines in India, they're called in the Thai languages the Sangvega Niyasatan, or the places for the arousing of urgency, Sangvega. And that quality of urgency, a sense of the priority of Dhamma practice, the importance, the power, the beauty and strength, the centrality of Dhamma practice comes really into view, becomes clear and apparent when one visits such places. Funnily enough, when I was in India for a year, about 7 years after Abhayagiri Monastery was opened, Lumpo Pasando and myself lived at this monastery in California, and after it was established for 7 years, then we decided to have successive sabbaticals. So I went first and spent the year in India, and I took the opportunity to visit the main holy sites, so you know, Bodh Gaya, Lumbini, where the Bodhisattva was born in Lumbini, Bodh Gaya, the place of enlightenment. The Deer Park in Varanasi, where the Dhammacakka Sutta was given. It's the Buddha's first teaching in Isipatana, outside of the city of Varanasi. And then Kushinagar, Kusinara, the place of the Buddha's final passing away. But what I found was kind of was interesting to me, that I was a bit surprised at, that some of the places where I was most powerfully touched, where that quality of Sangvega really arose, wasn't so much the big popular shrines, but it was the places where the Sangha had lived, the places where people had gathered and practiced, where people had committed years and years of their lives to Dhamma practice. So, for example, the Jetavana, even though the Buddha spent 25 rains retreats at the Jetavana, Prince Jeta's grove, outside of the city of Sarvati, it's not one of the most common or heavily visited of the holy places. I spent the whole rains retreat nearby and would go to the Jetavana every day. And quite often there was only a handful of people that would come to visit. And it's about a mile and a half, maybe not quite 2 miles from the ancient city of Sarvati. And even though being in the Jetavana had its own powerful impact, I was really touched when going down to where the ancient city of Sarvati was. The remains of the city walls are still there. These large mounds formed in a sort of circular form, and the places where the city gates were, there's still like a gap in the ramparts, in the walls. And it's a strange thing, but walking along that path from the Jetavana, then going through that gap in the wall, there's this sangvega, this sense of a kind of urgency or immediacy. I think the sense of the power of the Dhamma itself really brightening the heart to know that the Buddha went on his arms round through this gate. He walked from the Jetavana, from the Prince Jeta's grove. He took the same path, as far as one can tell, that I'd walked on, and went through this gate. So probably the level of the ground was a bit different from the Buddha's time, but here's the gateway, here's the path. So it's, you know, through this gate that the Buddha himself would have walked in a line of monks. And the eastern park at the eastern end of the city of Sarvati, where the ruins of the ancient nuns community, as a Ashokan, the remains of an Ashokan pillar there. Again, there's a gateway close to that, the ancient nuns monastery, and realizing, oh, yeah, the nuns walked through this gate. When they went for alms in Sarvati, they walked out of the monastery there and then through this gate. And that sense of contact over the centuries, that this ground has been, might have, you know, changed many times over with the shifting of the earth and the coming and going of the seasons, but that sense of connection, the sense of relatedness of 25 centuries ago, people dressed exactly like me, with the same robes, the same shaved head, walked along this path in this spot, and these moments of contact, even though it's just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, it's just the sight of a path or an ancient wall. It's just the feeling of the ground under your feet. It's just the sound of the wind through the leaves of the nearby trees. It's just, you know, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. It is just the sense world. But as the Buddha said, that going to these places, it gives rise to sangvega, to a sense of urgency. And I think that my experience of it was it's a very non-conceptual, it's not a theoretical kind of contact. It's not a making a list of all the things that happened in that spot. But there's just almost like a refreshing, an invigoration of the heart that says, this is what you're connected to. This is the most important aspect of your life. This is what really matters. You know, this. I feel that sense of what's called sangvega, or that urgency, or immediacy, the immediacy of the Dhamma. And the inspiring or invigorating quality that has. That's why we visit holy places. I'm not trying to make this into a kind of an advertisement for pilgrimage. They're sort of not running a travel bureau, but just reflecting on why so many people, so millions of people over the centuries, have made the effort to go on pilgrimage, and why this has a virtue or a power. Even though these going on pilgrimage, traveling to some place, visiting a shrine, it is just seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching. the great benefit I find of being in such places and having those moments of say the clarity or the immediacy, the presence of realization of Dhamma, they're significant, they're important, because of the way it helps to change our priorities. It's so easy for us with a human life, the mind to be dominated by feelings of comfort or discomfort, feelings of happiness or unhappiness, feelings of excitement or depression, different moods that we can experience, the memories that we have, the ideas we have, the plans that we have, the list of things to do that we've got. All of our lives can be so easily dominated by the concerns of the people that we live with, the illnesses of our body, the lists of responsibilities that we have, the many and various duties that go with our lives, and so much of that can dominate the picture that becomes all of who and what we are, or the things that are most important in our lives. But to one of the most important things of the pilgrimage and visiting such places where that immediacy of the Dhamma, the presence of the Dhamma, the kind of sanditiko, akaliko, apparent here and now, timeless quality of the Dhamma becomes apparent. It's like, oh yes, well, that's just my list of things to do, or that's just the illness of the body. So, or that's just this unfinished business that I've got. This is just that letter I need to write. Well, that's just the plan for tomorrow. So, it puts everything into a perspective that there's a way that our priorities get changed. Yesterday, when Lumpo Pasanno was giving the Dhamma talk here, he was quoting one of Lumpo Cha was particularly gifted in coming up with very brief and very clear and succinct brief expressions of guidance for Dhamma practice. And if you remember, he said that in particular, there's two qualities: wake up, let go; be awake, let go; be awake, let go. That's what it's for. And so we, because the mind is clouded by ignorance, we most of the time we're not aware of all the things that are being held onto, that the mind grasps. Our memories, our ideas, our emotions, our moods, our plans, our opinions, our responsibilities, our families. Yeah, there's a whole array, a great spectrum of attachments that the heart creates, and it all seems so real, it seems so important, so significant, and it doesn't even look like attachments, it doesn't even look like conditioning. But what we are doing when invigoration of the heart, or that letting the heart be refreshed and awakening to the presence of Dhamma like this, then it's that waking up, then it helps the heart to recognize, why is this being held on to? Why are you hanging on to this opinion? Why do you take this particular perception to be real? Why is this so important? Why are you so excited about this? Why are you so afraid of that? Why do you take this particular perspective to be absolutely and completely true? Today someone came to visit and was talking about how they related to Dhamma talks, and thinking, I used to be quite happy with an hour-long Dhamma talk, but it seems a bit long. It'd be better to have Dhamma talks a bit shorter, maybe half an hour. And I really think that's a good idea. And I said, well, that's your perspective, but not everybody sees that way. Someone might hear a half-hour-long Dhamma talk and think, oh, that's three times too long. 10 minutes is plenty. How can you go on for a whole half hour? And someone else might feel, what? Finished already? It's hardly even begun. It's only 30 minutes. It's just warming up. You know, can't stop now. There are over and over again, I like to reflect for myself, and I like to encourage us to see that our perceptions are very subjective. And another example I gave when we were sitting there chatting in the sala today, I said, you know, you might look at that mat and say that mat's red, but if you're colorblind, it's not red. It could be, yeah. If our vision is average human vision, we might say, yeah, but no, but the mat really is red. But if you're colorblind and you've never seen the difference between red and green, and what you experience is shades of what you call brown, then what is really being seen? Is the mat really red? Or is it just because when your eye sees that particular kind of light, the brain says red, gives it a name? Not sure if Ajahn Karunadhamma was here. There he is, yes. I frequently use him as an example, case in point. So if I might mention Ajahn, Ajahn Karunadhamma is red-green colorblind. And so this was a very regular lesson in the early days at the Bhayagiri Monastery. Say, it would be like, say, Christmas time, and somebody would bring in some plants with, you know, very, very green leaves and very, very red flowers, a sort of red and green contrast being a sort of Christmassy feature. And I say, oh, you know, that's very festive, very seasonal. And Ajahn Karunadhamma would look at me and kind of go, looks brown to me. Or words to that effect. Yeah. Oh, right, he can't see. There's no contrast between what I call red and what I call green. There's no particular contrast there. Aha. I was fascinated when he said, I think even before he was a bhikkhu, and he used to be a layman, an anagarika driving us around, when he said, when coming to a traffic light, that he had to learn, you know, the red and the green ones by the position of the lights, not by the color that is seen. You know, which one is shining? Is it up above or is it down below? That tells you whether it means stop or go. But there's no distinction in terms of color. Oh, so when we reflect that our perceptions are subjective. What we call beautiful or ugly, it's subjective. What we call too long or too short, it's subjective. Like, you know, Lumpu Cha would hold up something and say, is this big or small? Like it's a lid from the water glass. He'd say, is this big or small? Or he'd pick up a stick and say, is this long or short? Say, if you say, oh, it's short, then if you were an ant, you'd call it long. Yeah. If you're an elephant, you call it short. But is it long or is it short? Depends on how you look at it. And I mention these things, I kind of bring this up over and over again in Dhamma talks, because these things are so important, because they reveal to the mind where that attachment is forming. What we take to be absolutely true, where we don't even realize there's an attachment happening. And we say, this is beautiful, that's ugly, this is right, that's wrong. It should be this way, it shouldn't be this way. That we're not noticing that the mind is attributing, it's giving value to that particular perception. And that the encouragement of Ajahn Chah, wake up, let go, is because when we try to hold on, when there is a clinging, whether it's conscious, whether there's an awareness of that clinging or there's no awareness of it, that necessarily, any kind of clinging necessarily produces suffering, because the clung to can't be held. Like the mind, no thing can really be owned. What we call things are processes, they're patterns of nature in a constant state of change. No thing can really be held. It can't be held, it can't be owned, it can't be possessed. That's why the feeling of ownership is dukkha, because you can't actually own anything. That's why any kind of grasping is necessarily painful, because that which the mind is trying to grasp, it can't be held, it can't be kept, it can't really be owned. There's no thing to own and no thing to do the owning. From the subject side, the I that feels like it's the owner or the doer, and on the object side, the thing which is being owned, the thing which is being grasped at, both of those are completely fluid and empty. They're both transient and unstable. So that's why clinging is always productive of suffering. So that the more that the mind is encouraged to wake up, when it wakes up, it begins to see where the clinging is happening, and when the clinging is recognized, then it can be let go of. The mind is able to see, well, why try to hold on to that? It's like trying to grasp a moonbeam, or taking hold of a waterfall, or trying to pick up a shadow. It's not going to work. There's no point. It's a ridiculous. It can't be done. And then there's that quality of recognition, of clear seeing, then leads to a relaxation of the heart, that this can't be owned. This can't be, say, possessed. There's no thing to worry about. There's no thing to get hold of. There's no thing to acquire. No thing to get and to have. There's a relief in the heart. There's a spaciousness and an ease in the heart. So this is, I would say, when we think of pilgrimage, or we want to arouse a sense of urgency or immediacy of the practice, then that's what it's for. It's a set of perceptions, traveling to a particular place, seeing particular things, or engaging in particular practices, devotional chanting or bowing and sitting and so forth. These are aspects of the conditioned world, the material sense world, but the purpose of them is to help the heart to awaken to its attachments, to its habits of grasping, and awakening to them, seeing them, then they can be dropped. They can be, say, allowed to end. And the ending of those habits, rather than anything being lost, the ending of that grasping results in freedom, in peacefulness. As long as the mind tries to go out and invest in the objects of the sense world, the place that you live in, or the way that you look, the feelings of the body, your judgments of liking or disliking of other people, and the mind gives that value and says, I want to be with this, I don't want to be with that, I want to have this condition, this experience, I don't want to have that condition. We're taking refuge in the sense world, which is necessarily painful and frustrating. The more that the mind awakens to the fact that nothing can be owned and there's no one to own it, then the heart embodies the Dhamma itself. The heart awakens to its own nature, which is, the best way of describing it is, the nature of the heart, of the mind, is Dhamma itself. That the mind is Dhamma. It's not a person. It's not a self. It doesn't belong to a self. The heart, the citta, is Dhamma, and it doesn't need to get anything. It doesn't need to get rid of anything in order to be complete or in order to be liberated. The Dhamma is self-sustaining. It is intrinsically unborn, unoriginated, uncreated, timeless. So when that habit of trying to seek security or satisfaction or from the sense world, or trying to protect oneself from the threat of the sense world, when those habits of fear or desire or aversion or anxiety, with relationship to the sense world, to our thoughts, our memories, our ideas, our emotions, what we see, hear, smell, taste, or touch. When the heart no longer goes out and is seeking value or seeing threat in the sense world, then it is able to rest, awake to its own nature. So we talk of letting go, but actually no thing has really been owned in order to be let go of. It's rather the illusion of possessing has been dropped. And in that illusion coming to an end, then the heart is awake to its own nature, that the Dhamma knows itself. So nothing is really being lost or relinquished, nothing is being gained. It's just what's always been here, the Dhamma that has always been the very center, the very fabric of everything, is awakening to its own nature. There's a great peacefulness, a great contentment, a great satisfaction in that. In the book that Lumpo Pasando and I put together on the teachings on Nibbana, there's one chapter called Atamayata, meaning not made of that. And this is a word that is uncommon in the Buddhist scriptures. I think it only appears about 6 times in the Pali canon. But it is a word that Venerable Ajahn Buddhadasa picked up, and for the last couple of years of his life, he spoke about it very, very extensively, gave long and extensive Dhamma talks on this theme. And atamayata literally means not made of that. A meaning not, tam meaning it's like not being consistent with that, or not being made of thatness. So it's hard to describe in English, but it's the opposite of the mind going out to inhabit its perceptions. So that in the ancient, say, understanding of how perception worked in the Buddha's time, it was seen that, as if, say, with a visual object, that the eye sent out a kind of ray that would be like a beam. It would occupy the object and then come back to the eye, bringing the perception of the object with it. So that, and that was called tanmayata, consisting of that or made of that. So that going outness and occupying an object, investing in an object, and then bringing it back to be known, to be received. So attamayata is not going out or not consisting of that, not getting drawn into seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, the mind not being born into its perceptions, its thoughts, its memories, its intentions and opinions, but rather resting in that quality of awakened awareness. So this might sound a little bit technical, but I feel that this is a very, very helpful word to reflect upon. And when Lumpo Pasano earlier today was giving some Dhamma reflections, that that quality of not going out into the world of things, the mind not getting absorbed, not getting born into approving, disapproving, not getting born into liking, disliking, pleasant or painful or neutral, but rather sustaining a quality of openness, attuned to the way things are, attuned to the qualities of perception. But not getting drawn out, not getting lost, not getting born into it, not becoming that. And again, earlier today, he was quoting this passage that where it's a comment made by Venerable Sariputta. He's talking with I think it was Ananda about his meditation experience, and Venerable Sariputta says, "Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. Bhavanirodho Nibbanang. Bhavanirodho Nibbanang. Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. Nibbana is the cessation of becoming. So when the mind is not born into an opinion, into a fear, into a hope, into something that we love, something that we're worried about, something that we've got an opinion about, something that's on our list of stuff to do, pleasant, painful, neutral, whatever it might be, then it becomes that. So that's this quality of atamayata is referring to the capacity that we have to not get born, to not become that. And then when the mind is able to know, seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, the feelings of love and hate, fear and desire, excitement, depression, sadness, exhaustion, energy and so forth, all of the different range of experiences, then when it doesn't become that, it's not switching off, it's not getting numb, it's not lost, it's not spaced out. It's rather the experience is that of Nibbana, the great peace of the heart when it doesn't get born. It's not going out and getting lost in its perceptions. So like right now, here we are, here's the experience of the temple, and it's 9:20 in the evening on the full moon night. So there's the sight of the temple, everyone gathered here, there's the sound of my voice, there's the feelings of my body here on the Dhamma seat, the sensations of my tongue in my mouth as I'm talking, the feelings in my knees, the particular patterns of light and shadow from the rafters and the lights and the shrine and so forth. So if the mind is drawn into the objects, the sounds and the shapes and the forms and the textures and the sensations, then there is a division, or the mind is drawn into the kind of multiplicity, it's born into the variety of objects. But if it's not lost in those, if it doesn't get born into those objects, but rather it sustains that quality of knowing, to know without grasping, to know without clinging, to know without being born into those objects, then even though there's a multiplicity, there's a variety, there's all kinds of shapes and forms and sounds, then there is also a profound simplicity, the quality of knowing that which is aware, that which is receiving the variety of perceptions, that is a unified, or that's not fragmented, it's not broken up into individual pieces. That quality of knowing or awareness is like the space that receives all the objects, like the space of the temple receives all of our bodies. The space of awareness is that space of knowing, receives sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, expectation, fear, hope, memory, imagination, intention, and the whole array of experience. The awake, aware heart receives it all and is not disturbed by that, is not burdened by that, is not agitated by that. So there's a quality of unity, and the unity is in the quality, in the awareness itself. So the objects are separate and various, many different objects, but they are unified through the quality of knowing. That really is the essence of what we call insight meditation. Vipassana is the clarification of that quality of awareness, training the heart to not get born, to not go out and get lost in its perceptions, its moods, its opinions, its hopes and its fears, but to develop the strength to receive the great variety of perceptions and feelings, to know them, to hold them, to receive them, and to not be lost in them, to not push them away, to not grasp hold, but simply to be knowing, to be awake, to be aware. So the more that we can establish that as the basis for practice, being that awake, aware quality, then whether we are sitting in one place and our life is very simple and plain, or whether we're traveling around the world, we're going to different places, being with different people, that quality of simplicity and unity in the heart will always be there. We don't find ourselves being agitated or disturbed by an array of different things around us, or if we have an illness or discomfort in the body, then similarly the mind is not getting bored into that, not getting lost in that, not getting carried away by that. The refuge really is that quality of awakened awareness. So, as is said over and over again, that when we take refuge in the Buddha, Buddhang Saranam Gacchami, that is stating this very intention. You're putting into words that very intention, that very, disentangling, that freeing the heart from its habits of becoming and being born, getting lost in it, its perceptions and thoughts and moods. And Buddhang Saranam, the Buddha, that awake, aware quality, is realized, is embodied as the refuge, that is the refuge. Buddhang Saranam Gacchami is stating the intention. Let the awareness of this heart, that awake, aware quality, be the refuge. Let that be where I go to. Let that be the place of pilgrimage. Let that be the foundation. And that as the practice develops, as the quality of insight strengthens, then we find that the Buddha refuge, that refuge in awakened awareness, being and embodying that quality of awakened awareness, gets more and more accessible, and the heart becomes more and more robust, more adaptable. We're able to experience a wider range of feelings and thoughts, happiness, non-happiness, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and criticism, comfort and discomfort, the range of what can be experienced without getting caught, without getting lost and tricked by the habits of our conditioning, that strength increases, and we find ourselves genuinely able to be at peace in the world, regardless of what is what's going on, what's happening within us or around us, the health of the body, the feelings of comfort or discomfort or whatever. As I was describing at the beginning of this talk, so I'm aiming to be traveling for about a total of about 6 weeks, and aiming to return December 22nd, so that's quite a while. So I am at the end of this time, and Lumpur Pasan know he's going to be going to Chittaviveka tomorrow morning, so we'll pay our respects to him and take leave of him this evening, so he can have a spacious morning tomorrow. He's aiming to leave about 8, just after breakfast time, so we'll formally take leave of him this evening. I can take leave of the community myself at the mealtime tomorrow, and I sincerely hope that you will sustain the quality of harmony. We can have that intention, but I would really encourage the active development of these principles, developing the insight, that the liberating insight, as I've been describing, to really take those feelings of, of excitement or fear or hope or worry or comfort and discomfort as they arise moment by moment, and to recognize these as patterns of the conditioned world, and to rise to the challenge, or can these be seen as changing aspects of the conditioned realm, and can the heart genuinely take refuge? Can it embody that quality of vijja, of that awakened awareness of being the one who knows, being that the refuge of awakened awareness? Can we do that? And then looking at when in those moments when we can do that, when we find that quality of spaciousness and accommodation, receiving everything, attuned to things, and not limited by things, then see what the result of that is. Because in that very moment, that Nibbana is the cessation of becoming, in that moment of the heart not getting born into like and dislike, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, and so forth, then look what's there. Look at the result. Know for yourself and say, oh, this is really peaceful. Oh, this is great. Aha, this is what it's like. And when those moments come, even if they're incredibly short, just a finger snap, sometimes it's just half a second or less, let those moments of clarity be fully known. In that moment where it's really recognized, oh yeah, there's a lot of things being experienced, but that which knows the experience is not limited by them. I can see, or hear, or smell, or taste, or touch these particular things, but the heart is not limited, it's not burdened by what it's experiencing. Oh! So in those moments of, oh, notice that. What is the quality of the heart in those moments of clear knowing? Know for yourself. Know it directly. Because in that moment, everything is really okay. Oh. Doesn't mean that we don't do anything. Doesn't mean that we sort of freeze in mid-stride or stop with our spoon, 3 inches from our mouth. The cessation of becoming isn't being frozen. But in those moments of clarity, notice how, the whole array of the sense world is here, but that which knows the sense world is not limited by the sense world. That which knows the time-bound and the conditioned is not limited by time, it's not limited by conditioning. It has no boundaries. It is completely free. It's completely unburdened. And I can say those words and you say, oh yeah, that sounds great. But more important is to know that directly in those clear moments. That which knows an uncomfortable body is not uncomfortable. That which knows a wave of anger is not angry. That which knows the feeling of a deliciousness is not delicious. That which knows disagreement is not disagreeing. It knows the feeling of disagreement. It knows the feeling of excitement or bitterness or sweetness. And in that moment of clarity, in we can see what the middle way is. We can see the way of the Buddha. We are embodying, the heart is embodying that way of the Buddha. It's being Buddha, being awake. And not just as a nice idea, but it really is being Buddha, that awakened, aware quality. It's being that, and not as an achievement, not as something that has been got, but something that's already here, that's being used, something that is already a quality of our own heart that is being clarified, being known, and being realized. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening. Please take what is useful and use it to dwell harmoniously with each other. And when there are times of difficulty or friction, then that's the best times to be even more determined to say, okay, now what's going on here? Where's this coming from? Or when you're excited and inspired, okay, I'm saying that is really good. And that my happiness is coming from that thing out there. So is that really the case? Or is it just that particular thing, that particular sense object, is producing a feeling? So what is it that knows that happy feeling? What is it that knows that anguished feeling? What is it that knows this this heaviness? Or what is it that knows this lightness? Ask those questions. And when things are challenging or exciting or inspiring or depressing, we can take those sort of hot or intense or those moments of friction to be exactly the things that help us to wake up, to clarify how the mind is getting drawn into the objects of sense and perception, and then in recognizing that, letting go, to drop that, to not be born into that, and in that not being born in that atamayata, not consisting of that, not getting lost in that, notice what is the quality, what's the texture, the flavor of the heart when it isn't lost, when it isn't born, when it's not getting carried away. And let that very knowing, that very tasting, that knowing, that texture, let that be what guides you. So I offer these thoughts for consideration this evening. And,